From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Curtis Sittenfeld has written about boarding school life in her best-selling novel, Prep, and about a woman very much like Laura Bush in American Wife. Now she's focused on the relationships within families, and especially the bond between identical twin sisters who both love and tear at one another. They also have a special power. They're psychics. This hour, On Point, author Curtis Sittenfeld on her new novel, Sisterland. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Have you read Curtis Sittenfeld's novels, Prep, The Man of My Dreams, American Wife? Have you picked up Sisterland? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from St. Louis, Missouri, is Curtis Sittenfeld, author of the new book, Sisterland. You can read an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Curtis Sittenfeld, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Curtis, I have to start with a parochial question. You had a scene at one point in your book where you describe one of your characters using a combination of hot pepper sauce and water to keep squirrels off of tomato plants. As somebody whose tomato plants were just stripped bare by squirrels, does that really work? And where did you get that?
Well, actually, a friend of mine told me about that who has done it supposedly effectively. So I don't have firsthand experience, but anecdotally, it does seem to be true.
Good. All right. I'll give that a whirl.
Go for it.
Let me ask you about something I've always wondered, in the same way that I've wondered about how musicians write, whether it starts with the words or the music. In your case, does a novel that you do start with a theme or message you want to convey, or does it start with a piece of material that you think, I can build out from that, I can work with that?
I would say the latter. So in this case, the story starts in 2009, the novel Sisterland starts in 2009, where there are two sisters. One of them is a professional psychic. One is a very conventional suburban stay-at-home mother. And the psychic makes this prediction that there's going to be a devastating earthquake in the St. Louis area. And as it happens, in 1990, a self-described climatologist made a prediction that there would be a devastating earthquake in the Missouri area. And so – and someone – I didn't know about it. I didn't live here at the time. But I always thought, oh, that would be such an interesting premise for a novel, to have the clock ticking towards something that, you know, probably won't happen but might, and throws people into emotional turmoil. So it was very much grounded in hearing about a real event and then putting my own spin on it.
So it didn't start with the sister relationship at all. It started
No.
with the earthquake and the prediction.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, so obviously I changed it. You know, it was an older man who made the prediction in 1990, and he actually died, I think, less than a year after he'd made the prediction. But I thought, you know, this sort of – it wasn't a prediction that ever had scientific credibility. And so in transforming the climatologist into a psychic, I don't really think I was stripping my psychic character of any credibility. But I thought, you know, the prediction is so interesting, but rather than tell the story from the point of view of the person who makes it, it would be really interesting to tell it from the point of view of someone close to the person who feels simultaneously, you know, embarrassed and implicated and also potentially worried that it might come true.
Well, it's kind of fascinating to me that that's where it started, because I'm imagining that certainly what I took as a father of three daughters and somebody who has a sister, there's only one girl in our family, that the messages and the interaction between the sisters is going to be the most resonant thing for most people. And yet that wasn't the jumping off point for the book.
Well, I think you're right that there's – you can describe this book in a few different ways, and you could say, you know, it's about a psychic who predicts an earthquake, which is true, but actually it really is much more about sisterhood and how sibling relationships change in adulthood. You know, once you go from living under the same roof to having sort of more free will, like, do you still voluntarily spend time with your siblings? Do you consider them friends? You know, are they the bane of your existence? And a lot of it also is about being the mother of young children, living in the suburbs, marriage. Like, it's actually about a lot of very conventional topics, which I hope I've explored intelligently, but it's not like I'm treading new ground.
The I remember when your book Prep came out as a Washingtonian, you having taught at St. Albans, there were some people who were scandalized by that. There were some people who were scandalized by the Laura Bush based character in American Wife. How did your own siblings react to this up close and personal glimpse that you have given, you know, informed by your experience of sibling life?
Well, so I'm one of four siblings. I have a sister who's 2 years older, a sister who's 5 years younger, and a brother who's 9 years younger. I don't think I've scandalized any of them. I mean, the people who know me in real life, I'd find me very unscandalous. I'm like pretty boring. But I think that I showed early copies to my sisters, and I think they both enjoyed it. And I think actually my older sister said she really appreciated the fact that it was not autobiographical, although she did literally, she said to me, "Are you psychic?" Which I was very flattered by that question.
Well, you don't consider yourself ever to have had psychic powers. The psychic element of it, how does that reflect your experience or what you believe about human beings and their ability to think about the future?
There's a character named Hank who's basically – he's the best friend of the main character who's the non-practicing psychic twin, although she does have psychic abilities.
Semi-retired, I'd say.
Yeah, this semi-retired. And Hank says, you know, I feel like there's so much about the world that's unexplained and mysterious, and why is having psychic abilities any weirder than, you know, questions about, like, why does the world exist? What is human consciousness? What happens after we die? And I basically agree with Hank that it doesn't seem beyond the realm of possibility to me. Or, you know, like, what is infinity? Are we the only ones out here? Psychicness doesn't seem any weirder to me than that. I mean, I don't consider myself to have, like, there have been times when I've thought, oh, I've had this intuition. But there are also times when I've thought I've had an intuition and it has definitely not come to pass.
But so, was that ever something that was present in your conversations with your sisters? Like, did you play with that idea or, you know, make-believe games or anything like that?
We didn't do make-believe games. I mean, again, I'm close to my sisters. We have been mistaken. My younger sister and I are frequently mistaken for twins. And once with my older sister, we were all at a Mexican restaurant and we were mistaken for triplets, which was very exciting. But I do think that you can, with your siblings, I mean, we all look alike. And I don't know, you can sort of know what your sibling's about to say, or you can be in a setting with other people and someone says something and you think, I can't look at my sister right now because we're going to burst out laughing. And it's not because of anything that would seem funny to other people. So you are communicating at this sort of sub-verbal level. I, you know, is that the same as psychicness? I would say probably not quite.
Have you gotten a special reaction from the book in your hometown of St. Louis, given the fact that you locate it near the site of what it was, New Madrid, where the quake occurred, right? The huge
quake
in the 19th
century.
Yeah,
so just to give a little – as you're saying, in 1811, 1812, there were four huge earthquakes in the boot heel of Missouri, you know, even though people don't really associate earthquakes with the Midwest. I actually grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio. I've lived in St. Louis for 6 years, but I'm not a native. And,
right.
And St. Louis is one of those cities where I think you can live here for 30 years and like you're still a little bit of an outsider.
Why are you in St. Louis, by the way?
For my husband's job, we're delighted to be here. But it was a little bit, you know, arbitrary, as job placements often are, that we ended up here. And he's Midwestern too, so it feels pretty familiar to us in pleasant ways. I think that for the most part, people in St. Louis have gotten a kick out of it or been amused by the, you know, the familiarity with all the references. Because it's like if I talk about a restaurant in the book, it's a real restaurant. Or, you know, there are a lot of flashbacks going back to the twins growing up in like the 80s and 90s. And I was so proud of myself. I toured the middle school they would have gone to, the elementary school, the high school. I found like the street where I decided that they lived. And I found the part that I was really excited about is that I found a woman who graduated from, you know, their high school around the time they graduated. And so I'd ask her all these questions like, in 1989, if you were in, you know, the Kirkwood area, which is the suburb where they live, and you were going to get frozen yogurt, where would you have gone? And she would say, Velvet Freeze. And then I would like take note, or, you know, like, what radio station did you listen to? Because I wanted those details to be real. Like, I wanted people who were from here to enjoy the book.
We're talking with Curtis Sittenfeld, author of the new novel Sisterland, about identical twin sisters with psychic powers. We'll go out on Billy Joel's This Is the Time, which is one of the many Billy Joel songs Sittenfeld's characters Kate and Violet listened to when they were growing up. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
This is the time to remember, 'cause it will not last forever. These are the days to hold on to, 'cause we won't, although we'll want to. This is the time, but time is gonna change. I know we gotta move somehow, but I don't wanna lose you now.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about sibling relationships, bonds, and rivalries with Curtis Sittenfeld, author of the new novel Sisterland. Curtis, I'd like you to read a section of your book where Violet unexpectedly shows up at Kate's dorm room after dropping out of college. They're going to go out for pizza. Violet looks for a jacket in Kate's closet. Can you read that?
Sure. Here, I said, from my own closet, I pulled out a fleece jacket and passed it to her. It was impossible not to notice that Vi's weight, which had stabilized in high school, had climbed again since we'd started college, and her face and body contained a new puffiness. Vi and I weren't beautiful. We had our father's long, narrow nose, but we could certainly be pretty because we also had our mother's large blue eyes and light hair. And yet with her dumpy ponytail and clothes, it almost seemed as if Vi were trying to look unattractive. It would have been mean to see her as a cautionary example, a warning of what would happen if I stopped climbing the Stairmaster every day. But after our time apart, both our similarities and differences appeared more starkly to me than they ever had before. Her hand reaching for the doorknob as we left the room, cuffed by the red fleece of my jacket. It could have been my hand. There was a way in which it was my hand.
Now, I love that passage, and I love the similarities and the differences. You know, on the one hand, you have siblings who sometimes get stereotyped into winner, loser, you know, sporty girl, girly girl. They're different ways of metrics of success and that sort of thing. On the other hand, you say, it was my hand. What were you trying to communicate, and how did that come out of your own sibling experiences?
Well, I think – so the sisters in the book, Vi and Kate, in some ways they're very different, but they also are very close to each other. And even – they almost define themselves in opposition to each other, which is a kind of closeness, you know, being like, I'm nothing like her, but it's like she's still
– So yin and yang.
Yeah, exactly. And so – I think that Kate, even though she can be – she's the, you know, again, more conventional one, even though she can be very judgmental about Vi's eccentricities, I think she also feels – I mean, she feels like they are one, or she feels like they – not that they are the same person, but that, you know, that they have this sort of blurred identity, or that what Vi – again, not in the kind of cheesy way, I guess I want to say, but like she feels like – if it happens to Vi, it happens to her. Or if someone judges Vi, they're judging her. And I think that's a lot of why she's so sensitive to how Vi will be perceived, because she thinks that she's sort of an extension of her sister.
Curtis, let's go to a viewer call – or listener call, excuse me. Susan is calling from Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Susan, welcome to On Point. What's your question for Curtis?
Hi, John. I just want to let Curtis know I just finished reading the book last week, and I really enjoyed it. I'm a bookstore owner, and I got your advanced reader, and it was excellent. And I have a sister. We're both very different, but both very similar. as the two girls in this book were, and I really enjoyed it.
Susan, are you psychic?
Actually, I think I am a little bit psychic, and after reading the book, I always listen to NPR, and I was shocked when I heard this was the topic of discussion, but I thought, I need to look into this more because I do have different things that either end up happening, just like the author was saying, and then some that absolutely do not.
Curtis, you have to like feedback like that.
Oh, of course. Well, you know, I have heard from two practicing professional psychics who both said they really enjoyed the novel, and I took that as a huge compliment. I've also, one of the probably biggest compliments I've received since the book came out is that I've had a bunch of twins say to me, you nailed the twin relationship, which, you know, I'm not a twin, so I felt some nervousness about taking that on, but they said, The hilarious part is actually a magazine editor I know who's an identical twin. She said there's that part where Kate and Vi on New Year's Eve, Vi kisses Kate on the lips at midnight. And she said that was totally disgusting, but everything else was exactly right.
Let's go to Paul, who's on the line from Westport, Massachusetts. Paul, what's your question for Curtis, excuse me.
Hi, John. I have read all the author's four books and picked up yet again a kind of a general negative take on the father figure or figures in each novel.
John, okay, wait, this is my father. We have to speak. Hi, Daddy. Thank you for checking in. This is very professional.
Why does the father seem to get knocked so often, even down to the long, thin nose, in negative ways? Did you have a difficult relationship with your father?
I think that maybe...
Was that a ringer?
Is not the place for us to sort this out. Yeah, this is my real father. Actually, I'm very close to my father. As you can say, you see, he's very not shy and retiring, but he's nothing like the father in the book.
That's very reassuring, John. Thank you for letting me ventilate my frustration.
Let me just have a postscript, Curtis. Would your father drive you to dates and wait outside while you had the date?
Yeah. Well, my father did.
Which is
actually
what happens in the book, by the way.
I know that. Yeah, that's a good explanation. My father did once set me up on a blind date, and so it was very the person. He was very nice. I felt like I had very little in common with him, but it was an interesting experience because I was sort of like, like this is who my father, I guess, would choose for me, or this is who my father might potentially like as a son-in-law. I never saw the person again, but yeah. So I guess my father. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that he would drive me to a date.
Let's go to Susan from Wellesley, Massachusetts. Susan, welcome to the show, but please tell me you are not a blood relative of Curtis Sittenfeld.
I can't tell you that.
She is.
I am. I am, and I was going to comment about the parents. Hi, John. Hi, Curtis. Because I actually did think the relationship with the parents was one of the more interesting things, but only at the end, because it was a shift. And I was wondering why the reviewers haven't commented more on that the focus is almost exclusively on the siblings.
Well, I think the book actually is a little bit hard to discuss because there are two major plot twists that occur at the end of the book. There's one major plot twist, and then there's some sort of fallout from that, and then there's some information about the parents that's not obvious in the beginning that is obvious at the end. And I think that it makes it hard, like instead of potentially spoiling, giving a spoiler, I think people just shy away from discussing whole segments of the book. Although, of course, if you look online, readers are not so restrained, and some people will say, oh my God, the end of the book, totally stunned me.
Well, it was stunning and not stunning, actually, from my point of view. I found myself, as you kind of eased into it, it seemed like it was a very logical kind of earthquake, if you know what I mean.
Well, and again, I think there's this line that's attributed, I don't know accurately, but to Flannery O'Connor, that you want what happens in a book to be surprising but inevitable. And I mean, again, it's up to the reader to decide whether I succeeded, but I do feel like I was going for that, where it's not what you expect, but then when you look back, you think, oh, okay, the foundation for that did exist all along.
We've got Anne on the line from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Anne, welcome to On Point. What's your question for Curtis?
Hi, thank you. Hi, John. Well, it's not as much a question as it is a comment that when I was young, my sister and I were young. We're not twins. She was 2 years older than me. But we did have a very strong, I guess you'd call it a psychic connection, because we discovered somewhere along the line that if she would focus on a photograph of something and I would be in another house, a friend's house or something, I would take a blank sheet of paper and I would draw what she sent me. And we tried it the other way around, but that didn't work. But the point is that it was a gift to me. It made me understand that that there was another dimension that we could access. And I never, ever had to question it. I never had to prove anything to anybody. I just knew that there was this other, if you call it spiritual world or not, it was something that we could access, and that maybe somewhere along the line there would be important messages you would receive about someone, something timely. There have been times in my life when I knew what was going on with another person, and I would give them a call to see how they are.
And to use a recurring rhetorical device that Curtis uses in her book, do you also use that to play the lottery in Wisconsin?
Oh, no. I don't think, I don't think if you use it for things like that, something doesn't feel right about that to me. No, I wouldn't do that.
Curtis, Anne is on message.
Well, it's interesting, actually. Yeah, exactly. In the book, because I think that, people who have no familiarity with the sort of, you know, psychic community, I think that's the number one question that they, like, why don't you just play the lottery and make several million dollars and never work a day in your life? And I think that, as Anne says, people say, oh, I feel like I was given this gift to help others and not to use it for my own sort of, you know, selfish gain. So it's interesting. But by the way, I feel like in having brought both Billy Joel onto the air and like this conversation about psychicness, I feel like I don't know, like these are not two topics or that you usually you know hear on NPR on a typical Monday.
Why Billy Joel, by the way? Why was that the soundtrack of these girls' childhood?
Well, it's partly just the time that they came of age. You know, again, they were born in 1975, which by coincidence was the same year that I was born. And it's funny because, you know, I think there are a lot of people, especially sort of self-consciously cool people, who hate Billy Joel really passionately. And then I think there are people who
I'm not
like,
one of those people.
Thank goodness. People who feel like it's fun to listen to a Billy Joel song when you're, you know, driving your car with the windows down. And I think that these girls, I mean, there are these kind of, as apart from the psychicness, or maybe including the psychicness, they're these wholesome Midwestern girls who they don't have, I guess, a kind of coastal self-consciousness or a kind of sense of what's a strong sense of like what's cool or not cool. And so they just like his music.
You write, in addition to the relationship about sisters, the relationship of parents with their children. And I found, as a parent myself, some of the loveliest passages about the just quotidian aspects of parental life. And the observations are very keen and insightful. But I'm wondering how parenthood affected you in the creation of the book. And in particular, you know, there are 3 years between prep – or I'm sorry, 1 year between prep and Man of My Dreams, 2 years between Man of My Dreams and American Wife, 5 years between American Life and Sisterland. What was the reason for that? Was it parenthood?
I know. Well, yeah, if you want to know how parenthood has affected me. So I have two young children. I have a two-year-old and a four-year-old now. And I would say in terms of – I mean, this is, if you said to me, what's it like to be a mother? Of course, that's a different question than how has having children affected your writing. So mm-hmm. to answer the sort of second question, it's actually made me, even though there has been this 5-year gap since my last book, it's made me more efficient because I can't, it's not like I can sit down in front of my computer and then read celebrity gossip for 3 hours and then start writing. You know, I have much less time. I have to be more focused and more efficient. And so I think that I'm a lot better at ignoring distractions than I used to be, especially sort of self-initiated distractions. But I did feel like, I mean, I really appreciate what you're saying about liking the passages about having young children. I mean, I felt like I wanted to depict that world in this realistic way. And I didn't want to make it sort of like cloying or, you know, it's not, the book is not primarily about having young children. And yet, if you have young children, they're a huge part of your life. So I wanted to sort of show what it really feels like and not the sort of cutesy or even like the overburdened version that I feel like is fairly common in pop culture.
Well, what I liked, there was one particular passage where you talked about the mother, and I may get the detail wrong, but the idea was you talked about a moment where you're sharing with your child and sort of doing nothing, and it was, am I sort of bathing in the joy of motherhood, or is it just the power of inertia? And both things are true at the same time.
Yeah, it's not mutually exclusive.
Let me ask you about how having young children affects when you write. Do you get up early and write? Do you write late after they go to bed?
No, actually, I'm very lucky because writing novels essentially is my job. And so I don't know how nitty gritty you want to get, but I work from about like, say, 9:30 to 3. I mean, I work sort of school hours. And we have help. You know, we have a babysitter who comes to our house. So it's, you know, I'm very lucky that I'm not teaching or doing other things and then writing on the side. Like, I am a writer. And people will say, I mean, I actually write from home, but that's not the same as, like, I'm trying to craft some paragraph while my 2-year-old is sitting next to me, you know, building, like playing with Legos. Like it's separate from that. I go to an office and I've never written fiction in the same room with my children. Like there's sort of other tasky, you know, to-do things that I'll do, but I never try to sort of access that fictional world.
Are you already halfway through your next book?
I would love to pretend that I am. No, not quite.
The subject of Sisterland, when we talk about earthquakes in particular, is there much of a consciousness in the St. Louis area of what happened in the 19th century? Because you think about California and places where there's a high level of awareness, I'm assuming that that does not exist in the state of Missouri.
Well, yes and no. So I don't think that, you know, if you went around and asked people who live in St. Louis, like, how worried are you about an earthquake occurring? I think that most people would say that they're not that worried, but they would say, oh, yeah, the New Madrid earthquakes that took place in 1811, 1812. I mean, so it's like people are aware of it, even though, you know, people outside Missouri maybe aren't.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking with Curtis Sittenfeld, author of the new novel Sisterland, about growing up with siblings and all that entails. Curtis, welcome back.
Thank you.
We'll see what other family members call in the remaining segment.
Heaven forbid. Yeah. Yeah, but I have a lot.
I'd like to get you to read a second passage for the book. This occurs when Kate and Violet and Kate's then boyfriend Ben are driving back to St. Louis. Can you read that for us?
Yes. And Vi and Ben basically don't really know each other. In Ben's car, I sat in the front seat and Vi sat in back, and Ben, looking at Vi in the rearview mirror, said, I talked to you on the phone, didn't I? You guys sound alike. And Vi said, I assure you the similarity ends there. And then she continued, embarking on a kind of monologue. But really, I only have myself to blame. No one knows Kate here better than I do, and that's why I should have realized she's not the person you turn to when you need a helping hand. If you behave yourself, if you're dressed up in your pretty clothes and acting all happy, then sure, Kate will give you the time of day. But at the first sign of trouble, she's out of there. She doesn't like conflict. She doesn't like weirdness. And watch out, because according to her, I'm just getting weirder. I had this amazing spiritual experience, probably the most amazing experience of my life. And Kate's like, yep, ignore it, pretend it didn't happen. In equal measures, I wanted to silence Vi, and I felt hypnotized by the drone of her voice, the inappropriateness of her disclosures, the way that if I could have scripted her dialogue in this moment, everything she was saying was the opposite of what I'd have chosen. It was hard to gauge how much sense she was making to Ben, but it seemed safe to assume that neither of us was coming off well. You know what, Kate, Vi said, but even then, when she was ostensibly addressing me, her words still had a distant performative quality. They were more for Ben than for me, and more for some invisible, sympathetic audience than for either one of us. Just because that stuff in eighth grade with Marissa sucked for you, that doesn't mean all spiritual communication is bad. You can choose to cut yourself off, and hey, it's a free country. That's your choice. But that's not how I want to be. I want to open myself up. I want to experience other dimensions. I don't want to be bound by the rules of this world. Does that make me a freak? So be it. Now, what's your name again? Ben? Ben, don't worry that Kate is like me. She's not weird. Yes, she has the senses. I cannot tell a lie. But she's going to hide them or die trying, so you're good to go with your vanilla romance. And you seem like a typical preppy guy, which I'm not saying to insult you. I'd assume most typical preppy guys are glad to be called typical and preppy. To each his or her own. What I'm trying to say is that I wish you and my sister a long and happy life together.
Now, Curtis, do you have as negative a feeling about the character that you created in Daisy / Kate as Violet does in that passage?
No. I mean, I love all my characters. I do. I think that as a fiction writer, it is sort of my responsibility to find them all endearing in some way. I mean, if I really hated a character, like why bother going to the trouble of creating him or her? You know, it's why, what's the point of that? So I feel like they all have endearing qualities, and they all have significant flaws. And, you know, of course, this raises the very large issue of, like, the likability of characters, and especially of female characters, because people seem to care more about if women characters are likable than if men characters are. But I mean, to me, I'm not looking to characters in a novel to be, like, a moral role model. And so I like them to be flawed and complicated like real people are.
Are you personally more the person who is out there and not filtered or the person who is more reserved and temperate and not revealing?
Actually, I would say that I'm a combination, as I think most people are. You know, like I can certainly understand people who feel like there's nothing to gain by ever having any kind of media exposure, you know, obviously, ironically, as I'm interviewed by, you know, on the radio. But and I can understand people who say, like, you know, you only live once, like be your big weird self and express your personality, and who cares what other people think. And, you know, it depends probably on the situation or the day. But neither of the twins is a total stranger to me.
In addition to having kids, the 5 years since you wrote American Wife and now have featured some pretty significant changes in American culture. We elected an African-American president. We've had big change in the attitude toward homosexuality, gay marriage, all of those issues. One of your characters is a lesbian. One of the key there are a couple of key relationships, one between Kate and one person you call scary black man, and then there's another African-American who she is friends with and involved with. How much did you purposefully try to weave themes of the changing American culture into this work?
Well, I wouldn't say I thought to myself, like, you know, how is American culture changing and how can I reflect that in my novel? But I think that I'm part of American culture, and so it's like, you know, it doesn't seem strange to me that a white woman and a black man, you know, they're both stay-at-home parents, would be very close friends. And it also, it doesn't seem totally strange to me that, you know, the white woman who's telling the story, even though she's very close to this man, she has this, you know, racial prejudices that she tries to conceal from him, but she has them in a larger way, or she has them with strangers who are less familiar than he is. And similarly, you know, Vi, it's the psychic twin, is dating a woman. I mean, whether she considers herself gay is a little bit murky, but she is in a serious relationship with another woman. And that's also something, I guess, I was interested just in exploring how there does seem to be, I mean, when you're talking about marriage equality, there seems to be this phenomenon of people feeling like, you know, some of the people who are not sympathetic to everyone being allowed to get married sometimes develop more sympathy when they have a family member who's gay. And so I do think that it's interesting how certain abstract issues, when they don't really touch us, you know, maybe they seem weird or distasteful. And then the closer they get and the more we have to kind of reconcile our own conflicts with them, or, you know, sometimes that can be opportunities for people to, like, grow or become more open-minded or more compassionate.
Let's go back to our listeners. Valentina is on the line from Boston. Valentina, welcome to the show. What's your question for Curtis?
Hi, John. I identify a lot with both the characters you're describing and as far as their family situation. I've not read your book yet, and I can't wait to read it. But my question is, as far as your development of the characters, what you consider to be like their backstory and their emotional life, something that I've experienced and had difficulty reconciling is being sort of like the really embarrassing family member. and in terms of, you know, there's culturally, I guess where I'm from, sort of a feeling or sense of selfishness. Like, how dare you be yourself when you're embarrassing everyone and all of us? And I don't really get the impression that your character has that. But I'm
right.
Wondering if that's something you sort of, like, considered in the development of those characters. And also, you mentioned, as far as how American culture is changing, the fact that, you know, when people realize they know someone who's gay, or when they know someone who's black, or someone who's in some way different or marginalized or whatever, that they can identify with that person a bit more easily. I feel like my job in my family, as far as being the weird family member, is to be the example of, you know what, I'm sure you thought all sorts of things about people who are this, people who are that, and they and them, but I grew up with you, we grew up in the same home, and you know me, and I'm they, and I'm them.
Valentina, thanks so much. Curtis, your thoughts on embarrassing family members and how you weave them into the book?
Well, I think, I mean, it's a very interesting question that Valentina is raising, because, you know, I do think that sometimes if you are different at all, it's almost like you have to be the ambassador for your difference. And even though maybe that's unfair or inappropriate, but it's also this reality. You know, like, it's sort of like, in some ways, I think this isn't right, but I think there are people, there are Americans for whom, like, Michelle and Barack Obama have to be the representatives of all black people. And it seems like Michelle and Barack Obama are very aware of that fact. Or, you know, if someone is, like, the only gay person in their family, it's like they have to sort of show their family, this is what it's like to be gay, even though obviously they're only themselves. And so I think that's a really complicated, complex issue. And I feel that fiction can be a way to, without rhetoric or without politics, to sort of delve into what it's really like to be a little bit different or to have these conflicted feelings. And I mean, again, as you're talking about, I write about race, I write about sexuality, all these sort of potentially awkward subjects in real life. But it's like those are part of life. And there can be people who are like nice and have some racist inclinations, or there can be people who are like kind of narrow-minded, but then they can be surprisingly kind to others who are different. So people are complicated, and fiction celebrates that in ways that I like.
You mentioned sexuality. Is it easy for you to write about sex in a book? I would think, like, just from my own point of view, it would be difficult, but is it?
Well, unfortunately, since I've done it in all four books, I think it's maybe easier than is advisable. Like, I would say that there's kind of this disconnect between, you know, I'm in my office, I'm writing a scene, and I think, okay, I guess it's time for these characters to have sex, and I'll just describe it. And then, like, you know, 3 years later, the book comes out, and people say, oh, my God, like, it's so graphic, And you know, I think, of course, secretly, there's a lot of people who like books that have graphic sex. So
is that why it's in? Is because it's as a marketing thing?
No. Because it's as embarrassing as it is like marketable, if not more so. I mean, but it's just like I try to depict characters fully as they really are, and it seems ridiculous to sort of. I mean, I show my characters on the toilet. Like, there's really nothing that right. I shy away.
When American
from.
Wife came out, there were a lot of people who said, "Oh my God, she's talking about sex between a president and a first lady."
Yeah, and diarrhea. Yeah, it's like a twofer. I mean, not simultaneous, but yeah, it's. I mean, I think there are people. Some people are very uncomfortable with certain topics, and some people feel like just put it all in there. And I guess I'm more like. I mean, in conversation, like if someone at a dinner party started telling me about like their, you know, GI problems in great detail, or like their sex life in great detail, I might think like, eek, you know, back off. But
or you'd be privately taking notes in your head,
or that, or I might have my tape recorder, one or the other. But yeah, in fiction, I feel like, I don't know. You know, it's just skim over that passage if it bothers you. Right.
Let's go to Helen from Mountain, Wisconsin. Helen, welcome to the show. What's your question for Curtis?
Hello, John. This is wonderful. I cannot wait to get this book. I'm wondering if she is familiar with the belief system that says that the soul chooses the family so that in that lifetime that it's going to experience, it will be presented with the situations that it has to accomplish in order to move on. I'm a spiritualist, and it seems to me that a great topic for a future book, if I'm going to read all of her books now after this, would be religion, because it's organized religion has really, I think, played havoc with us to try to keep us in control. So I'm wondering if she's familiar with that belief system.
I'm not familiar with that belief system. It's very interesting, but I had not previously heard anyone talk about that.
What was the role of religion in your life growing up?
Well, my father is Jewish, my mother is Catholic, and they both, you know, my father sort of went to temple, and my mother like mostly went to church. So, and we celebrated. You know, I was baptized. We celebrated Christmas, and although we also celebrated Passover. So it was, I mean, obviously the fact that my parents married each other, I think, would reflect the fact that they don't follow religion in a letter of the law way, but it was a force in their lives.
Let's go to Mark Anthony, who's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the show. What's your question for Curtis?
Hi, John. Curtis, I'm perfect timing. I thought I was going to be out of timing. How did you overcome, in your book and in your own life with your siblings, personality differences? And I heard you say people were complex, and even our own siblings are complex. And I am one of four. I'm the second oldest, number two. And the number third girl, two boys and two girls, and the number three child is just totally different from the rest of us. And the youngest is a girl also. So if you could comment on that personality difference, does your parents help you blend and adapt to one another, or was it just natural?
Thank you, Mark. Curtis, are you a believer in birth order as a big influencer?
I mean, I feel like if there's an article about birth order, I'll read it and be sort of intrigued, and then I'll kind of forget. I mean, I know that the oldest, which I'm not, is supposed to be very responsible, but I don't know. I mean, I think that in my own family, my siblings, we're one of those families who, like, we squabble, but we basically get along and enjoy each other's company. And I don't think there has been, you know, kind of major conflicts where...
Is the oldest in your family the one who's on the city council?
No, actually, that's my... So we have three sisters, and then my baby brother, who shockingly has not called in, is a city councilman in Cincinnati, where we all grew up.
So no rebellion there with the youngest?
I don't think so. I mean, again, because it was different for him to be a boy, you know, after three girls. There wasn't that much for him to rebel against, I guess, in my opinion.
Let me just ask you, when you think of all the books that you've done, what do you think has the most universal theme, and how has that influenced your conception of the books?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I mean, in some ways, Sisterland probably, because, you know, if obviously there are people who are only children, but for any people who have a sibling, I think that Sisterland might have something recognizable to them.
Well, that was my assumption, was that it would be the most universal books. Curtis Sittenfeld, good luck with the book. I really enjoyed it. It was a terrific piece of work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Curtis Sittenfeld is the author of Sisterland. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, two fine country gentlemen, Vince Gill and Paul Franklin, join us from Nashville to lay down some licks off their new CD, A Tribute to the Bakersfield Sound. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thank you.